This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Amid a credit squeeze, the mortgage meltdown, and the bonfire of the 401ks, many conclude that something is wrong with the system. And some go further to argue something is wrong with capitalism. In the November issue of Harper's Magazine, several eminent economists and respected business people weigh in with ideas on how to save capitalism. We're about to talk with two, Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and Eric Jansen, a former venture capitalist. And we want to hear from you. How do you think the system has helped you? Or how do you think the system has failed you? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation, where you can also find a link to the Harper's Magazine forum, How to Save Capitalism. Later in the hour on the opinion page, we want to hear from Republicans about the meaning of Colin Powell's Obama endorsement. We'll also talk with former Republican Congressman Mickey Edwards. But first, fixing capitalism. Economist Joseph Stiglitz is university professor at Columbia University in New York City. He joins us from a studio on the Columbia campus of the business school campus. And Joseph Stiglitz, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
Merriam-Webster defines capitalism as, quote, an economic system characterized by private or corporate ownership of capital goods by investments that are determined by private decision and by prices, production, and the distribution of goods that are determined mainly by competition in a free market. Quite a mouthful. Clear that up for us. What's a good, simple, short definition of capitalism?
Well, the problem is that we don't really have any capitalist, real capitalist system in the kind of definition that you began with, and probably there never was. That story focused on the key role that markets play in allocating resources. What we've just seen is the government coming in with a massive bailout. But even before that, our resource allocations were very strongly affected by government tax policy, government's investments in infrastructure, a whole array of government policies. So we have what might more accurately be described as a mixed private-public system, a mixture which is extraordinarily hard to get to work well, and in which too often many people using free market rhetoric have tried to have a kind of partnership where the private sector walks off with the profits and the rest of us walk off with the losses.
Hmm. One of the things that you talked about, all the incentives that are built into the system. For example, the government thinks it's a good idea for people to own homes, so they let you write off your mortgage payments.
If you're upper income, and one of the curious things about the current crisis is that it's lower income people who are losing their homes, the so-called subprime mortgage market. These people do not receive the tax benefits, partly because they're on lower income tax. Some of them have so little income that they're not even paying taxes. So while the government distorts the real estate market by picking up 50% of the interest and property taxes of upper-income Americans in many states, it doesn't help poor Americans. It's a very curious system.
You also talk about incentives as something we need to change if we're going to ride out this crisis and hopefully look toward the next one.
That's right. I mean, one of the things I point out that if you don't change incentives, you're going to wind up having a very similar behavior to what we've had in the past, that many of us, I included, expected the kind of bonfire that we've been having. We had distorted incentives that were encouraged short-sighted behavior, excessive risk-taking, and we got what the incentives encouraged. We have now given the banks a lot more money to play with, $250 billion. But if we don't change incentives, we don't change the regulatory constraints, why should we expect their behavior to be any different?
Well, for example, I mean, are you talking about incentives for individuals or incentives for heads of banks and people like that?
Oh, exactly. We have to think about these at the organization level and at the individual level. At the individual level, worth noting the big contrast in the sense of accountability that they have in the UK and in the US. In the UK, the CEOs of the banks that had to be recapitalized with public money had to go. They were fired. In the U.S., we said, oh, you know, you've done such a fine job of mismanaging your company. We have confidence in your ability to continue. And no one was asked to leave.
We're asking listeners to join us today. Our number is 800-989-8255. Call and tell us how the system has benefited you or how it has failed you. Again, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Joseph Stiglitz, as you look at this confusion of incentives, is this something that is in need of tinkering, of what we would call reform, or are we getting down to something pretty basic?
We're getting down to something pretty basic, and it actually goes at a higher level. We have a problem in our system of corporate governance. This is something that we've realized now for over three quarters of a century, the separation of ownership and control. The kind of capitalist system that is often talked about in simple textbooks has a small firm owned by and managed by the same person. The person who owns it runs it. But large American corporations, the guys who run it, will have a very small fraction of the shares. And too often, they run the company as a personal fiefdom, not for the shareholders, but for their own benefit. An example brought home recently, in the financial meltdown that we've been having, New York Times pointed out that the losses that the financial firms have made in the last year and a half have more than offset all of the gains that they made from 2004 through mid-2007. Well, you might say, since these firms didn't earn any money, the managers of these firms surely should not have gotten any bonuses. Those who got incentive pay should not have gotten any incentive pay for not having produced anything. But that's not the way the system worked. It worked. It was designed for a heads I win, tails you lose system for the managers. They have their pay. Yes, they would have been far better off if the system hadn't gone down. They're complaining. They're whining about the decline in their share prices. But the fact is, rather than being worth hundreds of millions of dollars, they're still only worth maybe a few hundred million dollars. But they are walking off with a lot, where the shareholders are walking off with big losses.
And this is due to short-sightedness. This is due to not looking, or not incentivizing the long term.
That's right. And it's to do with a system of corporate governance in which the managers run the system for their own benefit. One of the things that I strongly criticized actually in one of my earlier books called The Roaring 90s, is the system of pay based on stock options, where when the stock goes up, whether it's because of something you did or because the stock market is booming, you get a big reward. When the stock goes down, what the companies do is find some other way of rewarding you, but not through the stock option. But the real problem with the stock options is that they encourage bad accounting, because if you're the manager of a firm and you can find some way of getting your reported profits up by moving a lot of the risk off balance sheet, you can get your stock price up and your income up. And that's one of the things that happened with Enron, and it's one of the things that's happening today with many of our financial firms. They reported high profits, gave big bonuses, big stock options, but in fact, there were huge risks buried off balance sheet, and those chickens have now come home to roost.
All right. We're going to get another guest on in just a moment, but we want to hear from some callers, too. How has capitalism worked to benefit you, or how has it failed you? 800-989-8255. Let's start with Jay, and Jay's on the line with us from Aspen in Colorado.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Capitalism, how has it affected me adversely? I guess I want to start with the assumption that capitalism is a wealth concentration system, not a wealth distribution system. So being a member of the lower middle class, I don't have the leverage to take full advantage of the capitalist system because I'm more on the outside as opposed to the inside.
Mm-hmm. But has it helped you or hurt you?
Two things, I guess a little bit of both. the subprime mortgage market allowed me to get into a property that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to get into, and I was able to sell it 2 years later because the market here in Aspen, Colorado was fairly good and fairly strong.
At that time.
At that time, yes. And so, you know, made hard capital and reinvested in the property, paid it down, paid down my debt. And lo and behold, I'm in a better position than most Americans because of that. But I'm also in the construction business, and, you know, the financing is freezing up. So some projects all of a sudden just hit, you know, a cold start. Get in your bills. We're done until financing available. So day-to-day effect, yes, there's a work slowdown.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, certainly in the construction business, are seeing that. So, Jay, you think, though, the future is rosy for you?
If we start looking at our capitalist system in realistic terms and not terms of fantasy of unlimited growth and a finite closed system, natural resources, it depends on whether Americans are going to have a realistic view of the Commonwealth and what that means. And
we just have a few seconds left. I wanted to get a response from Joseph Stiglitz before we have to go to a break.
Well, you've raised a number of interesting issues. First, the system that many people believed in, which was called trickle-down economics, where you throw enough money at the top and everybody benefits, that hasn't been working. And in fact, we have more accurately described trickle-up economics. It's the people at the top that keep doing better and better, and those down below have not had it easy particularly in the last 8 years. Median income, that is to say, people right in the middle, have had stagnant incomes for the last 8 years. The capitalist system has winners and losers. The problem is right now, the way it's been working in the last few years, there are more losers than winners.
Jay, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you there in Aspen. We're going to continue our conversation with Joseph Stiglitz about how to fix capitalism. Also joining us will be Eric Jansen, author of Reindustrialize and president of iTulip Incorporated, a former venture capitalist. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to the United Nations, at least 20 million more people around the world will lose their jobs sometime between now and the end of 2009. Governments are stepping in to bail out banks and reassure investors. Clearly, the world faces an economic crisis. Some say capitalism is broken. We're talking today with Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist and university professor at Columbia University. We also want to hear from you. How do you think the system has helped you or failed you? Give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Eric Jansen, president of iTulip Incorporated, a former venture capitalist, and like Joseph Stiglitz, a contributor to commentaries at a Harper's Magazine forum on how to save capitalism. And he joins us today from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
And you say reindustrialize. What do you mean by that?
Well, my argument is that the U.S. economy has, for about the last 30 years, become too dependent on what we call the fire economy, the finance, insurance, and real estate industries. And my argument is that we need to de-emphasize those and re-emphasize production and consumption, particularly production.
And so stop working in the world of virtual world and start making real things again that people use?
Well, we do make a lot of things already, and we have obviously a very high degree of competency in technology and biotech and nanotechnology and other leading high engineering content and high intellectual property industries. The problem is that since the early 1980s, the emphasis of our economy has been on finance and what we've seen is the financialization of the economy and also our productive industries.
And so that the biggest generators of income and money in the system have been, well, consumers, and that's not going to change, is it?
Well, yes, that part of the structure is problematic as well. You can't really build a sustainable economy on borrowing and consumption. Sustainable economies are built on saving and investment. And the way for us to get from here to there is to reemphasize those areas of our strengths that are already there but are really have been suppressed for a number of years and need to be re-emphasized.
Well, we were talking with Joseph Stiglitz about incentives. What incentives do you think are necessary to reindustrialize?
Well, the first thing we have to do is remove the incentives that created the financialization. Some of those are removing themselves. The big one was the decline in interest rates since 1980. I don't know if you remember, but back in 1980, we had something like 19% inflation and 20% interest rates.
Now, the misery index, Ronald Reagan called
it. Yeah, it was a pretty tough time. But this is the Paul Volcker Fed's effort to reduce inflation. It was quite effective. It put our economy through two major recessions, and coming out the end of it, we had decades of growth. The problem was that as the cost of money declined with interest rates, the interest rates that lenders could charge remained relatively high. So as the interest rates that financial firms borrowed at declined from 19 to 18 down to 3%, down to 1% in 2003, and they could continue, for example, in the credit card industry to lend at 18, 19%, mm-hmm. Well, that becomes a pretty profitable business. And the problem is it's so profitable, it's more profitable than making stuff. And so, for example, a lot of our car industries, which 30 years ago primarily made their profits from selling cars, well, let's put it this way. One mid-level executive at a top three firm, a car automaker, told me, well, 30 years ago, Eric, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that that makes cars.
Joseph Stiglitz, I wonder what you make of reindustrialize.
I agree that we should think about finance as a means to an end, but it's become an end in itself. And I mean, it's really striking that in the last few years before the recent catastrophe, 30% of all corporate profits were in the financial sector. You know, that means that as opposed to people that were actually doing things, 30% was going into people facilitating other people to do things that mattered. Now, in my mind, I want to emphasize, I don't think industrialization is the key issue. Companies like Google, companies that provide services, those are real firms that are actually doing something. It's the financial sector, which is which was actually just based on a bubble, and generated an economy that was based on a house of cards, that should be the focus of our criticism.
Let's get some callers back in on the conversation. Let's go to Virginia. Virginia with us from Richmond in Virginia.
Hi. I wanted to say I was born after the last Depression, just retired recently, and it's been a bumpy road, even though I was raised by parents who were very cautious after the Depression, and I've been very careful and didn't even own a house until I was 50. My portfolio has gone up, down, and essentially down this whole time with one hit after another. Mr. Stiglitz was talking about the 80s, and then came the 90s, and then came 2001, and it's just been depressing. I did work early for municipal government, and I did have a pension at that time, but it was converted into a 401k, and then I was on my own for how to invest it. We just don't have the ability to know how to do it, and it's a house of cards anyway, as your speaker was saying. So for me, it's been a loser.
Can I just comment? I agree so much. Look, if ordinary Americans are being asked to manage risk when the experts, the so-called experts, the guys who ran our bank that walked off with millions of dollars couldn't manage risk, it just doesn't make any sense. So I think it's a good thing that we didn't fully privatize our Social Security system, which President Bush tried to push 3.5 years ago, because that would have meant that there would have been no security blanket at all. And many of those people would have put their retirement accounts, their Social Security into stock. That was what everybody was recommending in those days. And they would be in very, very tough times today.
Virginia, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Greta in Minneapolis. In 2005, I was given a mortgage with no money down. However, I had a credit score of 750, which has since gone up. So the economy has helped me. I would hate to see programs like this go away for the people who can afford a house payment but don't have 20% to put down. And 20%, Joseph Stiglitz, that's a figure you cite in your article in Harper's.
That's right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that most people that can't put down 20% would probably be better off renting for a while, saving, and going on then to buy a house when they've saved, rather than the credit card mentality that has pervaded our society. I think part of the thing, of course, that we have to do is level the playing field between renters and those who own their own homes. Our tax laws really discriminate against those who haven't been able to save the amount. We should have a special kind of almost, you might say, max saving, that if you put away a certain amount in the savings accounts, if you're lower income, the government will match part of that and help you build up the nest egg so that you can buy a home. And you can buy it with a certain kind of security. So many of the people who bought these interest-only loans have now lost those homes and with that lost their life savings.
Well, if I
Eric, go ahead.
Sure. Well, this FIRE economy I'm talking about, one of the things that happened over the very long duration of the dominance of the system is some influence, heavily influenced over our political system, so that a set of subsidies in the interests of particularly of real estate developed over that period of time, starting with the Tax Relief Act of the 1980s and 1990s, the ability to write off the interest on capital gains on a primary home sale up to $500,000 for a couple every 2 years. These are massive subsidies of an industry which, if you were to come to the United States from a different country, say France, for example, that might have a reputation for being somewhat more wealth-distributing than us, they would be quite shocked to find that array of government subsidies that we that our real estate, our residential real estate industry enjoys, including the interest rate deduction off income tax and these sorts of things, which are actually in violation of France's constitution because they represent an unfair redistribution of the rent burden from one group of society to another.
Well, let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Eric. Eric with us from Gambier in Ohio.
Hi. I'm a family farmer in Gambier, Ohio. We're about an hour north of Columbus. I have really a question that I'd like Professor Stiglitz to respond to. He's one of my heroes. We raise livestock, primarily sheep and goats. We don't get any subsidies. Most people don't realize livestock farmers don't get subsidies. And our second, so that's one issue. A second problem is that we live within striking distance of Columbus, so the price of farmland has been driven up by the exurban sprawl phenomena, and it makes an artificial price on farmland. And you're just talking about the influence of the real estate industry keeps that possible. And the third thing is that the regulatory apparatus is very burdensome. We sell our lamb direct to customers through local markets. And whenever you're a small guy and trying to meet the regulatory requirements that are designed for factory farms, it's a problem. And the other thing I guess I wanted to mention, I wanted to say at the beginning there, is that the subsidies go to the row crops. In our area, that's primarily wheat, corn, and soybeans, so that essentially the product is subsidized for ConAgra, Continental, the grain buyers, who then can turn around and sell it in world markets at a price below its cost.
Well, you get your team of accountants on all that paperwork, Eric, and we'll get an answer from Professor Stiglitz.
Well, you're absolutely right. A lot of people talk about our agricultural subsidies without realizing that the vast majority go for to only a few crops, wheat, corn, and that much of agriculture, fruits, vegetables, livestock, don't get subsidies. And so it's the agriculture itself sector that's distorted. Also, interestingly, almost all the money goes to a relatively small number of very large corporate farms. It is actually a very unequal program. Most of it goes to corporate farms, even though they talk about it as helping small farmers. The issues of that he focuses on how taxes, tax deductions can distort markets is also important, because we have this tax deduction for upper income Americans for their real estate taxes. It helps drive up the price of land, and that, of course, is one of the problems that he's facing in purchasing land. Finally, let me mention the problem of regulation. What concerns me right now is regulations on the financial industry, because we deregulated, and that deregulation of the financial industry has a lot to do with our problem. I was mentioning earlier about the loose money. Well, the loose money combined with the lax regulation was an explosive mixture which has exploded. It's absolutely essential that we restore some sanity and have appropriate regulations, including regulations focusing on the incentives, focusing on the regulations on the form of pay that the executives get. A lot of discussion about the level of pay of these banks. It's obviously it's been outrageous. But part of the problem is the form of the pay, including stock options, which are non-transparent, that not even the shareholders who bear the burden really know how much their CEOs are walking away with.
Excuse me, I
just have to interrupt to say you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me reintroduce our guests, Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz and Eric Jansen, author of Reindustrialize in Harper's. They both contributed to a forum there, and the president of iTulip Incorporated. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sure. The political reflex in this country after you have a debacle like we've just had in the mortgage industry, and previously as we had in the technology stocks in the NASDAQ, is to put together a very heavy-handed punishment of the innocent, like Sarbanes-Oxley. And I think it would be a mistake for us to go in too heavy-handed and try to over-regulate the lending industry, which will, again, make a lot of politicians popular, but I don't think it will fix the problem.
Aren't these derivatives? We're in an unregulated market. Isn't that part of the problem?
Oh, absolutely. Derivatives, the exceptions would be credit default swaps, and many derivatives need to have a clearing, an exchange, a clearinghouse, and absolutely have some level of regulation. Also, some form of reinstitution of many of the principles of Glass-Steagall, which separated investment banking from commercial banking. In other words, risk banking from standard business loans. I think it's been proven over and over again that they just don't mix. They have completely different incentives.
All right. Eric, good luck to you. We appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
And I wanted, just a couple of minutes left, I wanted to ask Joseph Stiglitz. Ben Bernanke said today before Congress that he thought another stimulus package would be a good idea. On Air Force One, President Bush said he was open to the idea. The Democrats have been pushing for one. Exactly what it is, we're not quite sure yet. But given the economic times, is this going to help? Is this rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic?
No, this is necessary. In fact, it's so amazing that it took Bernanke and Bush so long to realize the depth of our problems. If they last February had recognized the depth of the problem and recognized that the kind of tax cut for was not going to work, that given the problems with insecurity of Americans, given their huge debt burden, a tax cut would not be spent but would be mostly kept in their bank accounts, used to pay off existing debts, and would therefore not provide much stimulus. If they had recognized these problems 6 months ago, 8 months ago, we would be in a lot better shape today. So it is good news that they finally have come around and recognized the realities. It's going to be difficult, though, because the president has resisted and resisted doing anything, for instance, about extending unemployment benefits. 700,000 to 800,000 Americans are about to run out of their extended unemployment benefits of 39 weeks, and that means they're going to have no way to support themselves. So these are among the things that we have to do, and we have to do them very quickly.
And we're going to have to end up quickly. Joseph Stiglitz, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it. Joseph Stiglitz, University Professor at Columbia University, the author most recently of The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Our thanks as well to Eric Jansen, the president of iTulip Incorporated, a former venture capitalist. When we come back, Colin Powell's endorsement. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now the Talk of the Nation opinion page. On Meet the Press yesterday, Colin Powell made his presidential endorsement. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State said he will vote for Barack Obama. General Powell said he admires John McCain, but he called the Republican presidential candidate unsure on the economy and said his running mate is not ready to be president of the United States. And he had this to say about his own party.
I have some concerns about the direction that the party has taken in recent years. It has moved more to the right than I would like to see it, but that's a choice the party makes. I also believe that on the Republican side, over the last 7 weeks, the approach of the Republican Party and Mr. McCain has become narrower and narrower.
General Colin Powell yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. We want to hear from Republicans today. Do you agree with General Powell? And no matter who wins the election, how will the future of the Republican Party be decided? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Mickey Edwards, a former Republican congressman from Oklahoma, once a member of the Republican leadership, now a lecturer at Princeton University, who's been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A today. Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be here.
And you wrote in a post at Politico.com that you have been shocked by the disgust with which prominent Republicans in every state have simply had it with what our party has become.
Yeah, well, I think the thing that is significant about Colin Powell's endorsement of Obama is that it comes after a long list of other prominent Republicans and conservatives who have expressed their dismay about either the Bush administration or the McCain campaign. And so Powell is only giving voice to a lot of people out there who agree that, you know, that the party has just gone off the tracks. And you know, Neil, when this started, the problem was George W. Bush, and he was very unpopular. And it was just John McCain's bad fortune to be the Republican nominee while Bush was in the White House. But that's changed. And now there's a reaction against McCain himself. He has been erratic. He has his campaign has been very mean-spirited and talking about a lot of things. You know, you just played this piece here. Yes, okay, everybody knows he's a liberal. That doesn't seem to be what people are very concerned about today.
Interesting that you talk about a lot of the intellectuals within the Republican Party who have seemingly recoiled in the last several weeks in particular. Is there an anti-intellectualism in the Republican Party?
Well, you know, Bill Kristol talked about that a little bit this morning in the New York Times, although he sort of celebrated that fact. There is an anti-intellectualism, and Sarah Palin gives voice to that. It's certainly not true. You know, I've taught at Harvard and Princeton. It's certainly not true, you know, that anybody who's there is automatically smarter than the people on Main Street. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, that we should celebrate the intellect. We should celebrate ideas and not demean them and dismiss them. And, you know, I would never have thought that the Republican Party, which we prided ourselves for so many years on being the party of ideas, would suddenly have become the party of reaction against thoughtfulness, against reflection.
The ideas were also easy to summarize. The Republican Party was smaller government, lower taxes, and spending on defense.
Well, it was not so much smaller government. That's now become the litany. But it was limited government, limited to what the Constitution permitted. But it was for other things than that. You know, we were for peace through strength. We wanted a strong military to keep the peace, not to find ways to go to war. We celebrated individual liberties and limits on government, so we were not in favor, would never have been in favor in the past, of a president proclaiming that as the commander-in-chief, he has all these unlimited powers. So it's been a lot of changes from what we used to say. The party has become, as Colin Powell said, much narrower, and it's dealing a lot in irrelevancies.
Like what?
Well, you know, for example, Bill Ayers was doing what he did, and it was a very long time ago when Obama was 8 years old. It was reprehensible. I don't know that he has really changed. But on the other hand, you know, I don't know that I'd want to be held responsible for anything that might have been done by anybody who ever had a campaign event for me when I was running for Congress. You know, the people are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about the Iraq war. They're concerned about competent management of government. And one of the things that concerns me is that so many people in Congress on the Republican ticket or in the White House seem to be anti-government. Well, if you're anti-government, don't run for office. You know, the idea, we're self-government. This is not a dictatorship. This is not the czar. You know, it's self-government. And I believe in self-government.
Well, both candidates seem to be running against Washington.
Well, they're running against Washington in different ways, though. They are both saying they're going to bring reform. And, you know, I agree with both of them. Actually, here I agree probably more with McCain, because McCain thinks the change that people want is less corruption in government. Obama seems to think, you know, that people want to move to the left. I don't think people want to move to the left. So I don't agree with that. But I do think overall there has been way too much focus in the McCain campaign on not only things like whether it's Ayers or other things perhaps in, I mean, when I watch, Neil, when I watch a rally in which Republicans attending McCain's rallies, you know, are shouting the nastiness that they shout at Obama, you know, it makes me cringe. I mean, that's not what we've ever been about. And I think we need to get a grip and go back to what our principles are and why we want to have a government that is responsive to the people.
To be fair, Senator McCain has denounced several
of
those comments.
Absolutely, he has. It's not his fault. But what Powell said was, you know, the problem was both with McCain, who has been erratic. I mean, what he did when the bailout was proposed, he said, well, let's put off the debate. I mean, that was just, that was grade school
suspended
stuff.
His
I mean,
campaign,
it was,
yeah.
You know, that was really pretty dumb, you know, but Colin Powell also made a point about the way the party has become. Much narrower, much meaner, much more focused on purely social issues or, you know, what is this, you know, country first? Well, I think, you know, people who are for Obama and people for McCain are also for the country, you know. So, I mean, there's just, you know, we've gotten into this bumper sticker war, and the bumper stickers are more and more meaningless coming out of the McCain campaign.
Do you see this as the legacy of the Lee Atwaters of the world, the people who said found a formula, said we can attack our opponent's patriotism and it'll work every time?
Well, I don't know if I would go back to Atwater. You know, I knew Lee, and it's possible that he would have approved this. Certainly, it's a legacy of Newt Gingrich and Karl Rove. I mean, we've seen that, and it's the legacy of George W. Bush, who tends to see everybody as either allies or enemies.
Let's get some callers on the line. Our guest, a former congressman from Oklahoma, Mickey Edwards. And we're asking Republicans to call us today with their reaction to the Colin Powell endorsement of Senator Barack Obama, the Democratic presidential candidate. And we'll begin in Mooresville, North Carolina. Nick is on the line.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I just wanted to say that I agree 100% with the colonel's decision. Being a Republican, I was faced with a tough decision the past week or two. It's been weighing on my mind, and I've decided the same thing. I mean, just due to a negative campaign, and a lot of it has to do with the vice presidential nominee. I mean, I think it was very, you know, he drew a line in the sand and, you know, decided which direction he wanted to go with the party, and that's really left a bad taste in my mouth. And I question whether I'm a Republican anymore. I'm just left without a party, so it's, I'm glad that there's others out there that feel the same way as I do.
Interesting. Mickey Edwards, all those years ago, Ronald Reagan said it was he didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left him.
Well, that's true. And if I can just pick up on that for 1 second, Neil, you know, the famous quote from Ronald Reagan was that government's not the solution, government's the problem. Well, in my book, I talk about that. And, you know, what he said was, in the current circumstance, meaning the Carter administration, government was the problem. But he went on in that same sentence, same paragraph, to say, you know, we're not anti-government. We're for a government that stands with the people and that creates opportunity. So a lot of the people who claim to be Reagan Republicans don't have any idea what a Reagan Republican really is.
Mickey Edwards mentioned his book. It's called Reclaiming Conservatism, How a Great American Political Movement Got Lost and How It Can Find Its Way Back. Nick, are you planning to vote November 4th?
Of course. And I think I've finally made my decision strong. I mean, I was a fervent McCain supporter before, but, you know, I think that I'm going to have to go the other way.
Nick, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And as you look at states like North Carolina, where Nick just called from, and Virginia, Republicans in an ordinary year would not have too much trouble winning those states.
Yeah, one of the things that's so significant here in this campaign is that the states that traditionally go for the Democrats in the presidential race are going again for, you know, maybe even by bigger margins this time, and going to sweep in a lot of congressional Democrats as well. And John McCain is having to fight desperately to hold on to the states that have always voted for Republicans. The states that George Bush carried last time are now in play. I mean, who would have thought at the beginning of this that John McCain was going to have to fight to try to keep Virginia? But that's exactly the case.
Let's get another caller. This is Jesse. Jesse with us from Granger in another surprise battleground state, Indiana.
Hi there.
Hi, Jesse.
I'm a Republican. I voted for Obama already. I voted early because I actually signed up to volunteer for McCain's campaign, but every time I got an email, it wasn't about the issues. It was about just stupid stuff regarding Obama. Should we put this song with this picture of Obama's face and a heart? You know, talk about the issues. You know, we have problems here in America. And I just, you know, Obama, he just reaches people, and he really, really cares about what everyone's going through, not just the top 5%. You know, he cares about everyone.
And what kind of town is Granger? And do other people there feel the same way, do you think?
No. Granger is a Republican. It's a little village. I live on Republican Row, and so I'm like out of the ordinary in my neighborhood right now.
So not too many Obama lawn signs down there?
No.
All right.
No.
Jesse. Thanks for the call, Jesse. Appreciate it.
Welcome. Bye-bye.
We're talking with Republicans about the endorsement yesterday of Barack Obama by General Colin Powell. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from Justin in Concord, North Carolina. I've been upset about the shrill tone of messages of the GOP, especially on immigration. Upset enough to get involved. On the balance of the issues, the GOP still has the best ideas, but now is the time for people of principles to speak out and act against the run to the gutter. And I don't think that Justin is alone there.
No, I think that's the main point. We used to talk about when we created the Heritage Foundation. I was one of the three founders of the Heritage Foundation. I was national chairman of the American Conservative Union, and when we were active there, we talked about the fact that we were the people with ideas and principles, and we believed in self-government, and we were going to show how you could have a self-government that was within the constraints of the Constitution and divided power, and we could make that work. And that's been lost. I mean, it is shrill now, and it is all about trying to take down Obama and smear Obama. And, you know, I am on the issues more of a Republican than a Democrat. I certainly agree far more with McCain on most of the issues than I do with Obama, you know, but we've got to get out of the gutter that John has taken us down into.
Some people describe Barack Obama as a transformational candidate because of the numbers of young people who have been so motivated to join his campaign. Do you fear for a lost generation of conservatives?
Well, maybe, although I would say it's transformational not just with young people, because Susan Eisenhower is supporting Barack Obama. Jim Leach, the former Republican congressman from Iowa, supporting Barack Obama. So it's not just the young people. You know, it's people like Colin Powell. It's people like myself. I'm not, you know, I haven't endorsed anybody, but, you know, it is a fact that a lot of people are moving over. And you know what? If the Republican Party can't stand for something better than this, then maybe people should leave it. I mean, until it gets its act together and comes back. I love the country more than I love my political party.
Let's get Ed on the line. Ed's with us from Chester County in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi.
Yeah. I've been a Republican since I like Ike buttons. And since John's become the candidate, starting with Sarah Palin, who I just feel is unqualified, I could have really written Colin Powell's message yesterday. Every point he hit, even negotiating with the enemy, is, I believe, the right path. But as your speaker is saying today, the party is just going the wrong way. The negative, the personal attack parts of the negative campaign. Negative campaigning, I think, is part of it. You have to attack the other person's programs, but not them personally. And that's just way too far.
All right, Ed. And have you voted yet in Pennsylvania, or are you going to wait for the 4th?
No, we don't have early voting. I'm registered. I have a Republican for Obama button on, and I plan to volunteer for the Obama side to help get people out.
Ed, thanks very much for the call.
You know, Neil, if I can, you know, one of the things that McCain brought up, and then Obama got into it too, was about Joe the plumber. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Joe and Jill and Kathy and Charlie and all the, you know, the people out there, that, you know, who are concerned about where this country is going, you know, they want to hear about, you know, what's going to be done about keeping the peace or about Iraq or about, you know, the economy. They don't want to hear about this guy was a bad guy. And you know, did you know his middle name is Hussein? And, you know, I think the American people, you know, are reacting as they should, against that kind of a political campaign.
And where is this generation of ideas going to come from? How is the party going to change? How long is it going to take?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to happen, sometimes you have to have a defeat. You have to get really wiped out, so you go back to the drawing boards. Now, here's the danger. The danger is that if McCain loses by a substantial margin, and that could well happen, there's going to be a battle then for the soul of the party. There are going to be people who feel like me, who feel that we have really blown it here. And there are going to be people who are going to be like the Rush Limbaughs, who are going to say, see, you didn't listen to us. You should have had somebody who was more hardcore right-wing than John McCain. So there'll be a battle over that. And if those of us who believe in government, but in limited government and self-government, if we don't win that battle, I think the Republican Party is going to fade into irrelevancy. It's going to be the Whig Party.
Mickey Edwards, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Mickey Edwards, a former Republican congressman from Oklahoma, now a member of the Republican leadership. His new book is titled Reclaiming Conservatism, How a Great American Political Movement Got Lost and How It Can Find Its Way Back. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Tomorrow, key witnesses recanted their testimony or changed their stories, but death row inmate Troy Davis is out of appeals. How is this fair? Join us tomorrow on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.